Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Mass, and I welcome you to episode 86 of The Prerogative. On this episode, we start Disney Month! Yes, it's a month overdue due to, again, situations outside of my control, but we're here again. I can't wait. You know, I've been looking forward to reviewing Disney movies. You know, I hold off all year long because there's so many Disney movies, Disney animated movies, I just want to review because, you know, they're so enjoyable to watch and everything, and really to dig into what is my favorite animated studio, at least in America, is Walt Disney. So, to get to watch, you know, the movies from the 90s that I love, to go back and watch the stuff from the 70s and the 60s and the 50s, you know, being a fan of the original Nine Old Men, as they're called, of Walt Disney, you know, Ollie Johnson, Ken Anderson, and the likes, you know, to be able to watch them work into, you know, their beautiful art, which, again, we're going to get into today, it's just always a joy. So where do we start with Disney Month? Well, you know, we're going to start in 1970s, where, you know, Disney wasn't necessarily the best animation studio in the land. They may have been the most well-known and maybe most popular and, you know, for that matter, as of animation. But, like, a lot of animation that was, you know, just for kids and all that, you know, it wasn't the most popular thing in general pop culture. It wasn't like the 50s and even the 60s, to where when a Walt Disney movie came out, it was this big thing because, you know, they came out only every couple of years. The time span between movies being made sort of shortened. There were a lot more movies that came out in the 70s. And, it, you know, I think the 70s is widely considered not some of Disney's or Disney Animation Studios' best work. As certainly, you know, there seemed to be a steep decline that started to happen starting in the 70s that ultimately finally ended in the mid-80s when, you know, Walt Disney Studios turned things around with things like The Little Mermaid and the such. Again, there's a great, great documentary in called Waking Sleeping Beauty that's just wonderful to see on that subject about that new guard of artists, you know, artists like Glenn Keane, artists like Mark Henn, artists like Andreas Deja, James Baxter, and the like, who, you know, really revitalized at that time Walt Disney Studios. But again, our subject happened in the 70s. And our subject is a story that is known far and wide and everybody loves. I am, of course, talking about the fabled story of Robin Hood. And that, of course, means we are reviewing Walt Disney's Robin Hood. The Robin Hood story, which uses, and pork, that word I can't say, that starts with an A, to describe human-like animals. You hear me screw up enough words, this is where I draw the line. But anyways, you know, everybody has their favorite type of Robin Hood. You know, there are those that like their swashbuckling Robin Hood and more of that Errol Flynn type of Robin Hood fan. There are those who like the dog gritty and rugged type of new modern Robin Hood and like that Ridley Scott, Russell Crowe type of Robin Hood. There are those that like an American Kevin Costner, Prince of Thieves type of Robin Hood. Me, I'm more of a Mel Brooks, Men in Tights type of Robin Hood, or in the case of Robin Hood himself, Carl Lewis type of Robin Hood, because I like my Robin Hood to have an English accent. Yes. And I like my Robin Hood to be in tights. Tights, tights! You know what the thing I realized in the past couple years? Because again, I was too young and he wasn't as famous as he would become in more recent years. I didn't realize until a couple years ago that Dave Chappelle was in that movie. I mean, I knew that actor was there. I didn't know he was Dave Chappelle. Of course, when that movie originally came out, Dave Chappelle wasn't as big as he would become. So, but it's great to go back. Wow, Dave Chappelle was in this movie. Richard Lewis is in this movie. I love this movie. But we're not here to review Robin Hood Men in Tights. Though, if you ask for it, I won't hold back from it. I wish they would release that movie, by the way, on Netflix again. But anyhow, we're here to review Walt Disney's Robin Hood. And again, you know, there's a lot of great distinctions of how they really approach the Robin Hood story. I think, and again, we're going to get into this when we get into story, but I think a word I'm going to be using is the idea that it's really more of a summary in its narrative and plot of the Robin Hood story of anything else. And it's very interesting. It kind of reminds me of, you know, an anime OVA. That this movie could have been like a mini-series rather than a movie, but they made it into a movie. And the way a narrative works out. And you know, all the codes and conventions are there, and we're going to explore all that. So with that being said, let's get into our review, starting off with our synopsis. Our story follows the journey and exploits of Robin Hood and his merry man Little John, who live in Sherwood Forest and help the good people of Sherwood Forest by robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. The evil sheriff of Nottingham and his posse are always trying to catch him night and day, but Robin and Little John are just too crafty for him. Meanwhile, the greedy and immature Prince John, with the help of his assistant Sir Hiss, has convinced his brother, King Richard, to go off on the Crusades, allowing him to take the throne and overtax the good people of England. As such, Robin Hood and Little John make it their goal to overthrow that phony King of England. This is Walt Disney's Robin Hood.
Done with that scurvy Prince John.
Oh, the world will sing of an English king a thousand years from now. And not because he passed some laws or had that lofty brow. While bonny good King Richard leads the great crusade he's on, we'll all have to slave away for that good-for-nothing John. Incredible as he is inept, whenever the history books are kept, they'll call him the phony King of England.
Apart from the phony King of England.
He stands alone on a giant throne, pretending he's a king. A little tycoon's rather like a puppet on a string. And he throws an angry tantrum if he cannot
got out of his way. And then he calls for Mom while he's sucking his thumb. You see, he doesn't want to play.
Too late to be known as John the First. He's sure to be known as John the Worst. A punch on that phony King of England.
So with that, let's get started, shall we? And let's get right into it with music, as we always do. Now, I find the music to be very, very interesting. A lot of it due to the fact that you have this very interesting thing of this story that's supposed to take place in England. And yet you have this distinct American country folk style of music. That is the, I guess, the main element of all the music that, for the most part, plays in Robin Hood. And when I say sort of country folk, you know, that southern style, mind you, I'm really more talking, you know, sort of that country and that folk style as is that Missouri, Mississippi type of style. And, I mean, northern Mississippi, not southern Mississippi. Not for any particular negative reason, but, again, it's that northern Mississippi, Missouri, dare I say Arkansas, maybe, type of feel to it. Because, again, it's more of that Midwestern, southern, you know, it's still south, but, you know, almost Huckleberry Finn type of country and folk type of music. I mean, that's, I think, the best way to describe it. Again, the music was done by Roger Miller, who was a well-known country folk singer at the time. And, you know, he played the rooster, and had a main hand in a lot of the songs in the movie. And there's sort of this distinct sort of Huckleberry Finn, southern, Midwestern, country folk style to it that's unique. I mean, I can't find anything bad to sit there and say of them having this style other than it really doesn't match England. But it's one of those things to where it doesn't hurt the movie, it doesn't help the movie, though, however. And so it's one thing, I guess maybe I'm on the fence about it. I mean, the music, mind you, is good. Whistle Stop is a, you know, interesting introduction into the film. Odila, again, is pretty good. Love, you know, is a very nice little love song. It's good. I can enjoy it. It's a... You know what? It's a very 70s... Or it's actually a very... it's a song that's very indicative of 70s Disney. I mean, for that matter, all the music sort of also fits into that category of does Disney 70s. You know, because there's also, I can feel connections to, like, what they did with Jungle Book and other stories, you know. And that's not just because, you know, Phil Harris does voice work in it. But again, it's not just that country folk style, it's also got that, well, it is the country folk style, but it's also a folk style that was very popular in the 70s. You know, everybody thinks disco when they think of the 70s. Everybody forgets sort of the rock style and that folk, American folk song style, you know, because this is the time where we got Bye Bye Miss American Pie. Oh God, I'm trying to remember her name, and I'm blanking on it. I'm blanking on a lot of their names. Dolly Parton, just to name one. You know, this is where she became big. You know, that country folk style was very popular in the 90s. And, you know, there's a bit of jazz influence in it as well. You definitely hear that in the big song of Phony King of England. So, overall, the music is good, because, yeah, and I do enjoy it, you know. I enjoyed Phony King of England. I enjoyed Not Nottingham. That was a just great sort of sorrow song that told that story basically that third act. Or at least it brought that third act to an end, as we'll talk about later. Whistle Stop and Odie La were just good, fun songs. Love, like I said, was an enjoyable song. So the music was enjoyable. It was fun. And I guess it did help the story. It did move the narrative along a bit. It just wasn't impressive and just didn't do it in a really big way that I can successfully sit there and say that it was to the benefit of the film completely. But at the same point in time, there's no way I can sit here and say that it was bad, because it wasn't. It was good, but still in that middle ground. So overall, the music is what it is. It's this very eclectic decision as far as this movie is concerned. Again, it's just one of those things where I'm just on the fence. I don't know which way to go, because I like it, I enjoy it, and there are definitely aspects of it that does help the story along, but it's not... I don't want to use the word bombastic, because it's not about it being bombastic. But it's just... Even when it helped the story, I guess, it helped the story in very little ways. Really, the only song that really did any story work were Love and Naughty Nottingham. I mean, they all told a story, but really it was only those ones that were at all involved into the plot. Again, this is the time where these songs, even if they did move the plot a little bit, the songs were there just for a, you know, reprieve from the story and for it to introduce a fun element into the story. Because again, these movies were made for kids. And so you use music to capture their attention so that they don't have to constantly listen to dialogue all the time. So with that, let's move on to animation. And let's start with that overall design. Again, it's those nine old men. You have Ollie Johnson, Ken Anderson, all the rest, you know, with the anthropomorphic animals. And yes, I did attempt that word. And I know I screwed it up. But again, it's that... It's very Disney's 70s style. It's very much that style that Disney had in the 70s. I say that's probably a better way to say it, by the way. I can speak English. Well, American at least. But that's a different story. But yeah, it's again, you know, when you look at Jungle Book and Aristocrats and... or should I say Aristocats, excuse me. I'm thinking of a different thing. A guy walks into a talent agent's office and says, I got an act for you. I'm like, okay, what's your act? And in comes his wife and his son and his daughter and his little dog, too, and they start... What's this? I can't tell this joke? I can't tell this joke? Oh, that's right, I forgot this is PG-13. I can't tell this joke. I'm sorry, but, you know, Aristocats, Jungle Book, you know, Robin Hood. So, the sort of the use of animals as characters, I believe you had the Little Rescuers was also a part of this era. This was a big part of Disney in the 70s. So, again, it's that sort of very 70s Disney cartoony. The use of animals, it's much more for kids. You'd also have the Sword and the Stone, which we may be reviewing later this month. But yeah, it's that classic 1970s Disney style. And again, getting to watch the original Nine Old Men, as I said before, because the line work is just gorgeous. Again, I'm watching this on the HDTV. Not that this movie was necessarily made for an HDTV, but at the same time, it was. Because to be able to sit there and look at the line work, and look at how just sort of simple, you know, use of the pen and everything can bring out such expression. You know, this is why I'm a fan of 2D. This is why I have the problems I have with CG trying to imitate 2D hand-drawn. Because you can't. Because it is a craftsman's work. And the fact is, these were some of the best craftsmen in the world when it came to animation. Now, they may not been the best movies because of, you know, story wise, but nonetheless, art wise, just it's gorgeous art to look at. It's gorgeous to look at the, you know, through the different codes and conventions that you can see, just through the art itself. Again, because you have the fox and the wolf, you know, as, you know, Robin Hood and the Sheriff of Nottingham. Now, both of those could actually both be either hero or villain. In this case, it's the fox that's the hero because he's smaller, and, you know, the wolf being bigger is the villain. At the same point in time, it's also in the way they color the characters that gives you that code of hero and villain. You know, the wolf is darker, and, you know, the wolf is gray. The fox is the auburn. I think is the best way to put it, because it's not bright red, but it's a brownish red. Auburn, I think, would be the best way to describe it, or maybe even walnut. You know, Maid Marian again has the same like coloring. All of the, you know, supporting protagonists have much more lighter color. You know, Prince John. Okay, but you all know that's Baloo, right? It's the same character design. We'll get into character design as well. We might as well get into it, because that's what we're doing now. So I kind of sort of segued there into character design. But yeah, it's just, again, that's because that's Baloo's design. But Prince John's design, they basically took that Baloo design, changed the coloring scheme, and again, you have that sort of, those lighter color conventions and codes there. And again, then with the villains, you know, we have Prince John being royalty, you know, has that golden color, but again, he doesn't have the mane. Again, I like that. That's how they distinct the evil king from the good king. The good king has the full mane, he's the, sort of the king of the pride type lion. And then you have sort of that mountain lion without the mane, that's Prince John, he's the evil one. You know, you have the snake and King Hiss is the villain, and the greens and the darker colors there to distinguish them, the villains. In looking into the production, that's apparently was something Ken Anderson didn't like, just how, I guess, stereotypical they made the codes and conventions. But at the same point in time, I can understand it. And it's what cinema is. Cinema is codes and conventions. It's how we tell story. So the character designs were all, you know, again, they were good. Again, it's classic 1970s Disney. But just to go back to, you know, that overall animation, again, it's that, I go back to line work, the use of colors, it's what has made Disney so distinctive over the years. Again, each era has something really different and unique about it. From the 30s, the era of the, you know, the 30s and the 40s, there's the 50s, there's the era of the 60s, and which was more psychedelic and more, exploratory, I should say, exploring different techniques and different art styles, you know, again, Sleeping like Beauty, Alice in Wonderland, just to name a few. You have more of that childish style here in the 70s, you have a bit darker style in the 80s, and of course, starting with 1980, Little Mermaid, you have that, really that idea, as I like to call it, the idea of that American anime style of the 90s, then, of course, you have whatever the thousands was, because thousands was really a hodgepodge. And, of course, now we're in the era of complete CG. I guess you can call it the 2000s was the rise of CG, and now we're in the control of CG. Yeah. By the way, I'm going to make this statement right now for anybody listening to it. I'm recording this the night before the Oscars. I know Frozen is going to win. But I would like to say that if Frozen wins and The Wind Rises loses, we riot. Who's with me? Riot, 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 riot. Yeah. Moving on. So I covered overall art, I covered character designs. Let's go into the action animation. And the action animation was very, very well done. You know, again, that sort of pencil, that those bold, thick lines, you can get a little scribbly with them, but everything seems smooth. The action animation was very, very well done. I loved how they choreographed all the scenes. They had a good balance of comedy along with action. In particular, that final big action scene where they're freeing everybody, taking all the money, and trying to escape Prince John. In particular, Robin Hood's escape. Well, it fit that sort of Errol Flynn type of action. You know, in him trying to escape and ultimately escaping into the moat. So I liked that. And then, of course, you had the action scene of the archery contest. That was just very cartoony and very Disney. Really all the way up to the American football scene with the chicken. But again, we didn't cover that in music, but they did sort of use outside music. In this case, it was, I guess, the fight songs of USC and Wisconsin. Because there's a moment to where, you know, Lady Cluck, I believe her name is, I'm looking at that, and, yeah, Lady Cluck is trying to escape Prince John after, you know, her and Maid Marian and Prince John and Robin Hood have, you know, made a fool of him, and they're trying to escape the archery contest, and she's the last one trying to escape, and it's like this football where she's giving stiff arm to rhinos, and it's like they're watching her running like that sort of old school run, like where you're watching somebody run behind. And it's like, wow, we just had a football scene, an American football in England. Okay. That had a lot more comedy in it. And overall, the action animation was really, really well done. And then you had the background and the special effects. And the special effects, I think, were the most unique in the fact that, again, it's all hand-drawn. So it's very limited. But the things they did, for instance, when they did a splash, it wasn't like today where they can do like all these water droplets in CG. Or even the Little Mermaid to where, you know, the splash really looked like a splash and felt like a splash. It was that thing of, like, it's giving you the code that a splash happened. You know, oh, here's, he's like, sure, oh, lines of water. And, you know, it obviously it's a splash. And again, also because it's cheap. But again, it's those codes that they use to do the special effects, which is something they really don't do today because it's much more detailed in its special effect work. So it's great to go back and be able to see that. The backgrounds were fun. The backgrounds were beautiful. Sherwood Forest was beautiful. Again, it is also that cartoony type of sort of classic peasant village and medieval castle. So that's, I think, the negative of the background. But Sherwood Forest was just gorgeous and really was the star of the movie as far as art is concerned. So overall, I thought the art was very fun to look at. Because again, it goes back to that classic Disney style of the 70s. And it is what it is. And you either like it or you don't. I don't hate it. It's not my favorite. But I do enjoy it. Because I always get to see those original Nine Old Men work again. So for animation, I do enjoy it. Well, that's it for the first part of our review. We've covered music and animation. It's time for us to take a break, and I'm going to pay some, you know, imaginary bills, and I am going to let you know about some people who do some wonderful podcasts that you should really check out. So we're going to take a break, and I'm going to play a couple podcast commercials for you, and when we come back, we're going to get into acting and into story. After these messages,
my name is Michael Bailey. and I am a terrible geek. I don't watch Doctor Who, I don't care for anime, I've never seen any of the Harry Potter films, much less read the books. I like Star Wars and Star Trek okay, but I've never really ventured far into the extended universes of either property. Hell, I have never even watched a single episode of The Walking Dead. So what do I like?
Comic books.
I've been reading and collecting comic books since 1987, and I've been a fan of superheroes for as long as I can remember. Some would consider this a hobby, but I prefer to look at it as what it truly is, a crippling addiction that I may never recover from. To deal with this borderline personality disorder, I started a podcast in 2007 called
Views from Long Lost.
Every 2 weeks, or so, depending on real life, I pick a particular series, or issue, or character, or whatever to talk about, and then I talk about them, because that's kind of the point of a podcast. Sometimes I'm alone. Sometimes I have a guest, like my semi-regular co-host, the irredeemable Shag, or my other semi-regular co-host, Thomas DJ, or with another friend from the podcasting world. The show is located at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com. And from there you can find the iTunes link, the email address, as well as the backlog of episodes.
Views from the Long Box.
A podcast about comics, or a desperate cry for help? You decide. Every other Tuesday, or so, depending on real life, at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be. It's still going up.
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu.
I lied when I said you could go. At least partially lied, for I will let you go to another dimension.
The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
Play it. Come on. Play it loud. Play it loud.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Illogic. Foolish emotions. A constant irritant.
Infantile out! Freak!
Two!
Belong in a circus. Right next to the dog-faced boy.
True!
I have come.
come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.
It's a super prize package worth $9,388.
Money.
This isn't the biggest bag over the head punch in the face I ever got. God damn it!
Ow!
Go away, Baden.
And now, together by live simulation via the internet, your hosts, Scott Gardner.
He killed a police officer, for Christ's sake!
Thank God damn what he didn't kill off.
And Chris Honeywell.
Keep away! Keep away from me!
You are physically repulsive, intellectually retarded, vulgar, insensitive, selfish, stupid. You have no taste, a lousy sense of humor, and you smell.
Looking at me?
Yeah, because she thought you're some kind of freak. Now, come on,
thank
let's
God,
go.
She likes me, eh?
Go away.
Shut up, you freak!
Julius, you...
I say shut up! It's a manhouse! A manhouse!
TwoTrueFreaks.com.
And welcome back, and let's get right into it, as we always do, with our cast and, of course, our acting. So our cast, as follows, is Brian Bedford as Robin Hood, the titled character, Monica Evans as Maid Marian, Philip Harris as Little John, Andy Devine as Friar Tuck, Peter Ustinov as both Prince John and King Richard. King Richard only really appears at the very end of the original cut of the movie. There is a extended ending that was done for the Robin Hood Most Wanted DVD release that happened in the late 2000s. Really only has that one line, but he voices both of them, which makes sense considering their lines and they probably were born together. Again, let's not get into that. Back to cast. Sir Hiss is voiced by Terry Thomas. Pat Buttram voices the Sheriff of Nottingham. Carol Shelley voices Lady Cluck. Billy Whittaker, Donna Orita, and Dory Whittaker voice Skippy, Sis, and Tagalon, respectively. Ken Curtis and George Lindsay voice Nutsy and Trigger, respectively. And Roger Miller voices Alan A. Dale, excuse me. The rooster, who's also the narrator. So let's go over this. I guess starting with our protagonists, the two main characters, Robin Hood and Maid Marian. I thought they were done extremely well. I like the voices. I love the use of English actors, and especially in an English story. I think it does bring some authenticity to it. And I thought they did a great job of playing the characters very simple. I mean, the one thing we'll have to sit there and say is these characters, because of the story, which we'll get to in a little bit, had to be played on a much more simpler level than the complexity that others might have. And I thought Brian Bedford and Monica Evans did a great job. I mean, you got the romance between Maid Marian and Robin Hood. You understood it. It made sense. You enjoyed it. You cared about them. Nobody here didn't care about their work. I felt everybody did a wonderful job on voice acting in that sense. So I thought they did a good job. Once again, Phil Harris steals a goddamn movie. We need to call Phil Harris the Shawn Michaels of 1970s Disney movies. Or maybe at least in Paternity 2, because he stole Jungle Book and he's stolen Robin Hood. Of course, he's Little John. He was just excellent and funny, and his singing voice. I love hearing Phil Harris sing. He's got that sort of great sort of Midwesterner sort of twang to his singing that I really enjoy and I find fun. And it gets, you know, as we heard Phony King of England earlier, him singing that, but really gets me into that song, you know. And that little bit of sort of Midwestern Southern twang that he adds into it, that I really like. Andy Devine, I love this Friar Tuck. Robin Hood and Shakespeare are like the two films that were my favorite characters are the friars. The friars and the priests that help the hero, the protagonist. And I love Friar Tuck and Robin Hood, and I thought Andy Devine did a great job. It was such a unique Friar Tuck, I think, and it's one of the things I think of when I think of Friar Tuck. Yet, oddly enough, when I think of Friar Tuck, I think of three Friar Tucks. I think of this. I think of the Friar Tuck in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And I'm blanking on the name, and I apologize, but he was very big in the 90s. And I think of Friar Tuck in Robin Hood, Men of Tights, which was Mel Brooks dressed as a rabbi. No surprise, that's my favorite Friar Tuck. But yeah, I thought that the kid, Billy and Dory Whiptaker and Donna Laurita, they did an okay job portraying the children. Carol Shelley, I thought did a great job as Lady Clock because she was absolutely hilarious as well. It's hard to not find her hilarious when she's got football music playing behind her and, she's like stiff-arming rhinos. I love that. I want to say it's Scottish / Irish. Again, I apologize if I offend anybody. I'm sure people are like, it's not Irish, it's Scottish, it's not Scottish, it's Irish. Yeah, I want to say it's Scottish, that Scottish accent that she added to it, I thought was, it was just hilarious. And it again, being that Lady Cluck was more of a comical character, to be added on for Maid Marian, it worked very, very well. And then you have Roger Miller, again, narrator, and he did his part, too. Giving the exposition when needed in the few lines that he had. And so he did his job very well. With our antagonist, Peter Ustinov, I don't have anything bad to say about his acting because he did a great job portraying Prince John as a sort of comical, phony king that he was. Again, I'm thinking more of story, and that's where I guess the side came from. Terry Thomas as well. Again, here you have these villains, and again, a bit of code and convention here, the villain's a bit effeminate, as opposed to the hero being sort of more masculine. Again, I'm channeling my inner cinema class, which should make my teacher very, very, very happy. But, yeah, it's a thing of to where, again, because of that sort of feminist and being very comical, and I'm just going to call it what it is, make my teacher really, really happy. It's another example of a gay character in movies. Just to bring up my cinema class, my teacher likes to point out when we're watching older films, or I should say earlier films, how he thinks a lot of times the villain is gay. And I'm not going to disagree with him completely. I mean, I think there's much of what he can't say again and all that stuff, but yeah, I can see where he's coming from. And part of what he points out is the villains are very effeminate. And you don't get more effeminate than Prince John, a man who, whenever he doesn't get his way, calls for mommy and sucks his thumb. Which, again, I thought Peter did a great job of voicing those scenes as well. Again, adding to that comedic villain. All the villains, for the most part, were these very comical villains. There's nothing really threatening about the villains. At the same point in time, Prince John had that moment to where he was really, really angry. And Peter did a great transition to that I very much liked. Terry Thomas, again, as the sort of sidekick for Prince John as Sir Hiss, I thought did a great job. Pat Buttram, I thought did a wonderful job as Sheriff of Nottingham. Again, another well-known Disney voice. Again, that southern twang that he had. Again, it's that thing that Because in one instance, you have these British voice actors. And then in another, you have these, you know, Phil Harris, Pat Buttam, Roger Miller, for example. They have this sort of southern twang to their voice that gives it this sort of Midwestern southern feel to it. Which more line fits with it, sort of this combination story of this British story being done by a studio that was originated by a man from the Midwest. I'm trying to make sense of it. It doesn't make sense, but it's like, in one instance, you have the British voices that you need, and the second time, you have sort of the classic Disney voices of the 60s and 70s that, you know, did a lot of work there. You know, when you hear, you know, Pat Buttam's voice, and when you hear Phil Harris's voice, you immediately think of Disney. So, and I guess that's what I'm getting at. But I thought Pat Buttam did a great job as a Sheriff of Nottingham. He had the comical side to him that he did very, very well, and the more hostile side that he did very, very well. Ken Curtis and George Lindsay were great comedic foils. Again, the vulture from Jungle Book being translated here as comedic fodder, and working extremely well. Having, again, that sort of great comedic duel connection there that you needed for the cast. So with that, let's move on to story. And I guess first let's talk about how this story is really it's the base summary of what the Robin Hood story is. For the most part, it's everything that you need to know about what Robin Hood, or the story of Robin Hood is. You have Robin Hood, he steals from the rich, gives to the poor, and he's trying to overthrow Prince John and his evil Sheriff of Nottingham, who are taxing the people, and restore the throne to its rightful ruler, King Richard, who's off fighting in the Crusades. It hits all the basic parts of this. Again, obviously, because it's for kids, you know, they're not trying to be that complex. To try to keep it simple and basic, you know, Robin Hood is in love with Maid Marian. It's part of the reason he wants to overthrow Prince John, to extend free her, to save the people. Everything is kept on a very, very simple level. There's not a whole lot of intertextual complexity behind what's going on screen. Foremost in front, it's targeted for kids. And I guess this is where the issue comes up. And this goes into point two, which is it has a very simple narrative because of this. And that kind of hurts the film. It really does. This along with, and we're going to talk about this, point three also hurts the film, but this along with that base summary. And again, there's nothing wrong with having sort of a very basic Robin Hood story, mind you. But is that along with this very simple narrative, you know, when you look back, this is the time of the 60s and the 70s. This is the time where Disney was doing a lot of things cheaper. You know, Sleeping Beauty, 1959, almost bankrupted the company. The decision to do things cheaper, unfortunately getting the absolute wrong ideas of what was wrong with Sleeping Beauty. I kind of had a talk about this with someone last night on a special that will be coming out soon, which will tell him exactly when I'm voicing these two parts of this review. But anyhow, it's just, again, because of all that, that short-term sort of damage that Sleeping Beauty did, and I hate saying that, you know, it led to, again, the, you know, things like what the animation was. And, you know, I talked earlier about the animation and it being what it was. And I really do appreciate it for what it was. It's 70s Disney. It's its own unique style. But at the same point in time, it's never going to be Disney's best style. You know, it's the Xerox process as opposed to what was up to Sleeping Beauty, the ink and paint process of inking and painting every cell. Here they just Xeroxed it to save money and time,
And, you know, again, it leaves those imperfections, that sort of etchy style to it. Now, mind you, I like that etchy style. But for a Disney standard, it's not Disney's best work. It's not an etchy style on purpose to be etchy. It's etchy because of the process. And then that's where sort of they have the negative, even though I do like the art. And then you combine it with this movie, that's very basic idea of what Robin Hood is, and the very simple narrative of everything. Obviously, being targeted at kids, it's what leads to the story not... I mean, the story's okay, it's easy to follow, but it leads to what the movie not being as good as it can be. Which is sad. And again, we're talking about Disney standard. Disney holds itself to a different standard than everybody else, as I'll be talking about in a moment. But yeah, it's that simple narrative, and it does really hurt the movie. It can be, you know, I'll be honest, it took me 3 times to finish this movie. I watched 20 minutes, I turned it off. I watched 20 minutes and turned it off. I watched the final 20 minutes and did this review. And it wasn't that I hated anything. There's nothing necessarily that I hate, mind you. But it's just boring. I don't want to sit here and say that nobody cared about what they were doing, but the process in which everything was being done felt like they were just going through the motions. Or at least what the CEOs wanted. So that, to an extent, that simple narrative makes that feeling of going through the motions feel like that's what's happening. And as such, hurts the movie. You then have, again, also the fact that nothing really unique happens in this movie. And that also hurts it. You know, again, it's that base story. Robin Hood is the Prince of Thieves with Little John, and he steals from the rich and he gives from the poor, and he wants to overthrow Prince John, and he is in love with Maid Marian. They're in love with each other. He rescues her. He stops King John. Turns him over to King Richard, and him and Maid Marian live happily ever after. It's the basis of the story. And there's nothing really unique that it brings to the Robin Hood story. You know, to an extent, if you look at most of the more popular Robin Hood stories, all of them bring something unique. You know, the Errol Flynn Robin Hood brings sort of that swashbuckling style of Robin Hood into canon to an extent. Russell Crowe's recent one add grittiness and more authenticity, a more complexity to, you know, based off historical fact. Prince of Thieves proved that Robin Hood could still be a blockbuster. It sort of added on the canon of the sort of the community of Sherwood Forest. Men in Tights made you laugh because it was a parody. And it introduced us to Dave Chappelle. For some reason, my favorite line... my favorite line by Dave Chappelle in that film is when they meet, Will Scarlet. And he's doing the nods. And, he clucks the air and goes, it's like, where'd you... He goes, like, from Georgia. What part? South Central? I don't know why that makes me laugh, and I'm getting off topic. But my point, I guess, here is that this Robin Hood has nothing unique that's really memorable that makes you remember this film. There's nothing unique that brings something to the Robin Hood story, and as such, there's really nothing memorable about this film. It's just a simple Robin Hood story. And why that hurts it even more is that when you take this into account to the simple narrative, and the art style and everything. This didn't need to be a movie. This is an example of one of the, you know, like Sword and Stone and some others that could have been a 3 or 4 episode television series or mini series, I should say. They could have just as easily put this stuff on TV and it would have been made me look that better than making it a feature film and putting it in theaters. You know, I talked about earlier how I kind of, you know, compared this to an OVA, an anime OVA, to where it's a 3-episode miniseries, and they put it out and it's popular, and then they decide to, you know, put some extra scenes, tie them all together, take out all the opening and closings, and make it into a movie, a.k.a. Gundam Wing Endless Waltz, which I love, by the way. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but here, this is just a feature film, and I guess my point to that is that it felt like a 3-episode miniseries, and it probably would have been better just to make it a 3- or 4-episode miniseries on television. And that does hurt the film, because again, it gives it the feeling like everybody, and like the film for that matter, is just going through the motions. You know, it's just going through the motions. Now, one thing about the story that I do like is the pace. I thought the pace was really well done. Again, very steady, but at the same point in time, it's also steady in that standpoint of, again, like I said, it feels like a 3-episode series. You know, this is, I think, a perfect example. You know, I talk all the time about how animation and music and acting and all that enhance a good story. But this is a perfect example of how a simple and by nature, unfortunately, not good story can actually end up hurting the animation and hurting the music. Because the music by itself is okay and somewhat good and enjoyable, but when you put it in context of what's going on in the story, and again, you have this sort of southern twine and everything, makes it unique. I mean, the music isn't that big of a deal in this case, but with animation, it gives it that etchy style and everything. Again, it's what leads to that thing of making it feel like it's going through the motions. You know, it is what it is. It's what the 60s and 70s were of Disney, but at the same point in time, it's not Disney's best work. And I think that's the what I come to when I review it. And if I had to review Robin Hood, which I am going to review Robin Hood, or just to give it a rating, I just did review it, mind you, but to give Robin Hood by Disney a rating, I'd give it a 2.5 out of 5. You know, it's there's nothing really technically bad about it, but it's just going through the motions. And I think I do enjoy this film. I do like it. It's a fun film to watch. You know, but I'm talking upon Disney standard here. You know, by far, this is one of Disney's worst films. But to put that in context, that's kind of like something I was saying on another podcast, my new CMG Reviews podcast, where I was reviewing ECW One Night Stand, and I said Rey Mysterio versus Psychosis was the worst match of the night. Mind you, we're talking about a match that on that night was the worst match of the night for ECW One Night Stand 2005, but would have been the main event and the best match of the night on SmackDown or Raw, and would probably have been the second or third best match of any WWE pay-per-view at that time. So putting it in context, is Robin Hood not one of the best movies that Walt Disney Animation has ever done? Absolutely. But in contrast, if it had been done by any other studio, in particular MGM, I'm looking at you, it probably would have been, if not their best, their second best film they've ever made, at least up to that point. And in today's standard, may have been one of their more memorable films. So it puts it in context that, again, part of the reason that this film isn't good is because of the Disney standard. But that doesn't mean that there isn't fair criticism to put onto it about its simple narrative and how the movie itself just feels like it's going through the motions. That being said, I do enjoy this movie. And, you know, there are people that enjoy this movie. It's, again, there's nothing in this film that it just hate and regrettable or leads me to be have angry emotions, you know, kind of like how Frozen does. But, yeah, it's just one of those things to where, yeah, I mean, it's a good movie, but at the end of the day, it's really just average. I enjoy it, but other people probably wouldn't. So, 2.5 out of 5 for me. So, that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, there are several ways you can contact the show if you want to give us any email, fan mail, or anything. One, you can email us at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That is absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can also leave us a comment on our Facebook page, which you can find at www.facebook.com and searching for the Absolution Network. We're the one with the image of Tom. You can also leave us a comment on the website itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Of course, while you're there, check out all the other 132 Productions content. That, of course, includes the Otaku Momentum. And, of course, my new CMG Reviews Wrestling Podcast, which you can find there on the site. The Shaft Plus Podcast with my good friends Gene and Chris, which you can find at www.shaftplus.com. And, of course, my other podcasting sites, which includes Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast, that you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, my Comic Book Crazy Podcasting Network, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. That, of course, includes my Comic Book Crazy Podcast and my Hexcast, which I hope to get back on soon. I've been away from that show far too long. Of course, while you're there, check out the sidebar and check out all our friends that you can find on the sidebar of the site. This, of course, includes Michael Bale interviews from the Long Box, along with From Crisis to Crisis that he does with Jeffrey Taylor, Brad Douglas's Spider-Man Crawlspace, Steven Schleicher's Mage Spoilers Podcast, and, of course, Scott Gardner's Two True Freaks Podcasting Network. So, that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. We have a couple things coming down the pipe. Next week, at some point next week, towards the end of the week, I will release the next single review, which will be on a much beloved favorite, and I thought about starting to sing the song there, but I didn't want to seem offensive. But it's an animated movie that spurned a musical that is award-winning. I am, of course, talking about The Lion King. But that's not the only good news we have. Oh, no. Over the weekend, I will be releasing part one of an epic review I did the other night with my very good friend Gerard, who you can hear on the Coen Saga Chronicles podcast. And we talked about one of my favorite and one of and his absolute favorite Walt Disney animated picture of all times. Of course, I am talking about Walt Disney's Sleeping Beauty. And ladies and gentlemen, this one's an epic. So epic, took 3 hours to record, and I have to break it up into two episodes. So look out for that this weekend. So until next time, my Toonami generation,
it's going to get too dangerous. Eagles. Well, that about does her. Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom, signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.